most people are here. And I wanted to continue on this morning with a little bit more on dealing with the problems in meditation, because there's a few which I hadn't covered yesterday and which are very important in order for people to enjoy the meditation as much as possible, because once you know what the problems are, you know where they come from, they're pretty easy to solve. And one of the problems for those who've meditated a lot is, again, expectations. Because it does happen very often that people have some good meditations sometime in their life, or they have it at the beginning of this retreat, and they can't get it back again. And they think, oh no, I had this wonderful meditation, it won't come back. And it's very obvious the reason why. It's because we have expectations. We want it to happen. Underneath our meditation is a very, very strong desire to get something, which means the mind can't create the sufficient amount of stillness for those states to arise. So instead of actually sitting under the tree, just being still with your hand open, waiting for the mango to fall, you're looking up, come on mango, when are you going to fall? I'm sure it's going to happen soon, which means that nothing ever falls. So whenever you've had a nice meditation and it's difficult to get back again, it's the expectation which is a major problem there. You know, you expect, oh, it's happened once, it's going to happen whenever I want it to. And please remember that you're not in control of the mind. So the mind will not just give you all these amazing experiences at your wish and control. Your job, and the only job you have, is to create the causes and conditions. And then these things grow by themselves. In just the same way a person plants a garden, you can't say, oh, may all my flowers bloom today, because I really need them to sort of, Valentine's Day tomorrow, I'll have to give it to my wife. Please, please, please come out tonight, roses. They won't follow your agenda. We all know that in nature, it has its own causes and conditions. The flowers, the trees, whatever, they grow according to their natural laws. And they are totally independent of what you want and when you want it. And your mind is just like that. It is like a garden. And all you can ever do is to create the causes and conditions so that these amazing experiences will come without any expectations. So, you know, to make the mind happy, to have a kindness, to be still. In other words, make peace, be kind, be gentle. And as long as you do that, you know you're creating the causes. And of course, eventually, those beautiful states come. But don't think, oh, I'm a really good meditator now. See, I can get into these nice states of meditation. It's nothing to do with you. These are not attainments which you can get certificates for afterwards. On my retreats, I do not give certificates out for nimittas. Here, Danya, you've got a nimitta certificate. Signed by Ajahn Brahm, confirmed, yes, you've reached nimitta stage. Give certificates out, first jhana certificates, so you can put them on your wall when you get back. See, I've got first jhana. Now, that may seem silly to you, but people really get into that. They get so proud. Yes, I've got a jhana, I've got a second jhana, I'm a stream winner. And it becomes such a personal attainment, you get very, very upset when somebody suggests that really wasn't a jhana. Well, I'm sorry, but that's not stream winning. And what happens with me especially, because I have a very, very strict, you know, I say the accurate description of these jhanas, then people know, I don't want to go to see Ajahn Brahm anymore, because that experience which I had, he said it's only nimitta stage. But the monk down the road, he says that's third jhana. So I prefer the monk down the road. So there's a bit of trouble here, because when we have expectations and attainments, it is actually coming from this term, which it was Chogyam Trungpa. He was a drunkard, he was a bad example of being a monk. But he did say some smart things, and one of the things he said was this idea of spiritual materialism. Just like you have materialism in the world, how much money I have, look, I've got a Porsche, you've only got a Ford, you know, I've got a big mansion, you've only got sort of an apartment, I'm better than you are. Now that sort of materialism you come across in the world very often, and that can sometimes translate into your meditation practice. It's called spiritual materialism. And part of that spiritual materialism is my teacher is better than your teacher. I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. He's much better than, you know, your teacher, whatever it is. And that sucks. That's really wrong. That's really not Buddhism at all. So I don't care, this is, by the way, I don't care whether you go to other teachers, whether you go to other meditation retreats. Wonderful. When I went to university, I went to many, many teachers. You know, even in just one subject. You know, somebody was good on astrophysics, someone was good on quantum mechanics. So you went to many different teachers. And their strengths combined to give you a really, really good understanding of your subject. So even here, don't say, you know, Ajahn Brahm is the best teacher, Ajahn Brahm is the wonderful super guy. No, no. Go to many teachers if you want to, because otherwise it becomes spiritual materialism. And the same with your attainments. As I said at the beginning of this retreat, you are here not to attain something, but to let go of things. And that's a totally different attitude. You're here to disappear. As a teacher, as I say on every retreat, I'm not here to try and get more disciples. I've got too many. I'm here to try and get rid of disciples. That's why I tell bad jokes. I'm trying to get rid of you. But you like them. You must be masochists. But no. So it's true, you try and get rid of disciples because your job as a teacher is to make every one of you totally independent so you don't need to come here ever again. You know, you're teaching, it's like at a school, a university. Want you to graduate, so you know everything about meditation. So off you go, you can go and do it by yourself. And you come here on self-retreats if you want, but you don't need teachings anymore because you know, you've heard, you've understood. So that's the whole job, to try and get rid of things, not to gain more things. And that's the same with attainments, because once you have this idea of attainments, you know, jhanas, then you'll be wanting. And that wanting, expectation, wanting, that is what will hinder you. That is the obstruction to progress. And so, you know, some of you may be thinking, oh, it's, what day is it today? Thursday today. We're over halfway, it's almost ended, and I've got nothing. Oh my God, what am I going to do? This has been a waste of time. What am I going to tell my friends? And what you tell your friends is, when they ask, what did you attain during this retreat? You said, I attained nothing. And nothing, as I said earlier, is better than God. And nothing is higher than anything. So what you're doing there is you're realizing this is a part of emptying, letting go. And if that is in your head, then the whole idea of attainments, all they really are stages of letting go. Stages of disappearance. How much you could vanish, not how much you can get. And when that's in your head, all this expectation, what do I want something for? I'm just accumulating more rubbish in my already overloaded brain. My job is to let go of things. Let go of all expectations. Or let go of all wanting to be somewhere else. Or somewhere else. Now, that is part of letting go. So, you will find in meditation one of the biggest obstacles is wanting, or to put it in another way, wanting to be somewhere else. And this is, again, expectations, it is desire, it is ill will, always never liking to be here but wanting to be somewhere else, wherever that happens to be. And this brings me to one of those stories of the monk who went into prison to teach. And after teaching for a few weeks, the prisoners asked him to stay behind. They were going to give him a cup of tea and some cheese. And they wanted to talk to him. And the question they asked is, what's it like being a Buddhist monk? What do you guys do? And when he told these prisoners of the ascetic life of a Buddhist monk, you know, which is sleeping on the floor. Now, I've got a bed here, but I sleep on the floor back in monastery. And just no eating, just no dinner in the evening, no sport, no sort of sex, no music, no movies. What else do? We work very hard, we don't get paid. And when we actually told these prisoners about what a monk does and how ascetic it is, these prisoners were so shocked because they liked this monk. And without realizing what they were saying, one of the prisoners uttered these memorable words to his friend, this monk. He said, "That's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" They said that. And they really meant it, because in a prison you get more than three meals a day. And they told me the breakfast, you think you've got lots of breakfast here, you should go to the jail down the road. Bacon, eggs, pancakes, a congee, whatever you want, it's there. And it's the same with lunch and dinner. If you want to be a vegetarian, you can be a vegetarian. If you want to eat a cow, you can eat a cow. You can do whatever you want. And these TVs in your cells, and probably many channels as well. And what else do? They can play sport, they can watch a movie, they have nice beds to be in, nice medical care, doctors there. We have to go out for the doctors. And they get, it all comes to them. They get so many things, and they've got no worries at all. Being in prison, you don't have to worry about sort of your husband or your wife or your kids. You can't worry anyway because they're out of there. And you just got no worries about your finances. You've got no money anyway, so you just, no worries at all in prison. And I often say that if ever I go to prison, now for some reason, I wouldn't be afraid at all. It'll be much more comfortable than my life over in Bodhinyana Monastery. And also, if ever I wanted to have a retreat, what they do is punch a prison officer and they give me 3 months solitary. I can have a retreat whenever I want. And actually, that happened once. There was the story of the Thai monk, Chökun Thep Sidhimuni. He was the abbot of Wat Mahathat. It's a lovely little story about a real good monk. He was the abbot of a big monastery in Thailand, a very good monk, and he was the next in line to be the Sangharaja of Thailand, the head monk with all the status and stuff which that would give you. He was not really that interested in that. He was just a nice monk doing his stuff. But the one behind him, not the first in line, the second in line, he was really a jealous monk. He really wanted to be the Sangharaja. And he realized that this guy was in his way. So, you know, this is the politics. When you have leadership in the Sangha, Mahanayakas, Sangharajas, abbots, and goodness knows what else, what happens then is you have hierarchies and you have jealousies and all the politics which come with that. So most of the monks are okay, but this third monk, he was not really that good a monk, and he really wanted to be the leader, so he had to get rid of this second monk. And in those days, you know, because the government was paranoid about communism, they somehow or other, they listened to all of his talks, this monk gave, and managed to take a little bit out of here, a little bit out of there, quoting him out of context to try and convince people he was a communist agitator. It's so easy to do that. I'm sure if you take my talks and snip a bit here, out here and a bit out there, you could prove that, you know, anything about sort of what I said. But unfortunately, that stuck. And they put him on trial for being a communist and they put him in jail. Now, as a monk, a Buddhist monk in Thailand, if you go to jail, you have to take off your robes and you wear white. But no, he was still a monk as far as he was concerned. And he didn't complain at all. A couple of years later, you know, the third monk became the head monk of Thailand. A few years later, there was a really strange car accident. Because the Sangharaja, the head monk of Thailand, was going off to the old airport in Don Mueang in a convoy, police cars in front, police cars behind, because, you know, he was an important person. And on the opposite side of the road, a car lost control and slammed into the car in which the Sangharaja was in. and just right by his seat, killed him. No one else was injured, just him. He was killed. And in places like Asia, when something weird like that happens, and this whole convoy, only one person gets injured and they get killed, they think that must be karma. And so they checked out, what would this monk do to receive such a weird karmic result? And of course, putting this guy in jail. And so they reviewed the case, and they totally turned it over. It was a miscarriage of justice. And they released this monk. And this monk, he wrote a little booklet, which I remember reading, about his experiences in jail. He had no anger or remorse at all. He said, it was a wonderful time. Thank you so much for putting me in jail, because when he was in jail, he didn't have to give any retreats. He didn't have to answer questions about nuns. He didn't have to... he didn't have to do any work at all. He had the whole day to himself. And he had his meal of the day, and then he was meditating. He could read all the books he'd always really wanted to read and rest and relax. He said it was a wonderful time of his life, being in jail for 2 years. And so he had no regrets at all and no anger about why he was put in jail. Thank you, thank you, thank you. There's a really lovely story there about a good attitude. Whatever happens to you in life, you can make use of it and exploit it to the max. He had a wonderful time. But it is more ascetic. And so these prisoners over in Casuarina jail, you know, why don't you come and stay with us instead? And I really thought about that. And why is it? It is actually true. I've been into many jails in Australia. They are very comfortable. You know, Western jails, you know, they're not hotels, but, you know, they're pretty close. And, you know, that's why don't people want to go to prison? Why are they trying to get out when it's so comfortable? Whereas in Bodhinyana Monastery, there is, last count, a waiting list of 17 people trying to get in. And nobody wants to leave. And it's ascetic by comparison. So what was the difference between a monastery and a prison? There's only one difference. In a monastery, everybody wants to be there. In a prison, no one wants to be there. And that, to me, became the idea, the explanation, the difference between prison and freedom. Freedom is any place where you want to be. Prison is any place where you don't want to be. And that's all the difference is. And from that, you understand why sometimes you're sitting in this comfortable place, meditating, but you don't want to be here. You want to be in jhana, or you want to have your breakfast or your lunch, or you want to be in bed, or you want to be somewhere else. Now you made a prison for yourself. And to be free, it doesn't have to be comfortable. You could be sitting here feeling really sleepy. If you want to be sleepy, then you are free. If you want to be somewhere else, you are now in prison. It's all to do with wanting. So, expectations, if you want to be in jhana, your meditation is a prison, and you will never feel the peace, the bliss of being free. The trick of meditation is whatever you're experiencing, whatever that is, want to be here. Don't want to be somewhere else. Because if you want to be somewhere else, you'll never have that form of letting go, meaning being free. You've always got work to do. You'll never be happy because you want to be somewhere else. You've made a prison of this moment. So in the meditation, if things aren't happening, you say, what do you mean aren't happening? Where do I want to be? And for goodness sake, want to be here no matter what you're experiencing. Then things start to happen. It's a great form of letting go, called freedom, wanting to be here. And it also happens, I always love to tell this story as well, because this is another problem with people. It's not just expectations where you want to be in that experience you had a long time ago, and I want to be here, and then the experience comes to you. The second thing which a few people have said during their interviews, that during this meditation retreat, sometimes you get very nice meditations, they're so peaceful, and then you don't get nice meditations, and you wonder what's going on. I was doing exactly the same thing, I was sitting down, following your instructions, letting go. One day it works, one day it doesn't work. Why? And the answer is that there is no such thing as a bad meditation. They all work if you understand the big picture. And the big picture is explained by the story of the migrant who came to Australia and got a job on a building site and worked hard all Monday, and at the end of the day he went home. His wife said, "Did you make any money?" He said, "No, they didn't pay me." He did the same on Tuesday, worked hard on the building site, got no money, and Wednesday as well. Thursday, okay, I'll just give it a try. Thursday, worked really hard, maybe 10 or 11 hours on the building site, and his wife said, "You get paid?" He said, "No, I got nothing, nothing at all. 4 days of work, I got nothing. I don't want to work again in Australia. They don't pay you." And the fifth day, on Friday, his wife sent him there just to get him out of the house because he was being very miserable. So he went to the building site, he worked, even not that long. And the boss gave him a big pay packet with lots of dollars in it. And when he went home, he was smiling and happy, and he told his wife, "I figured it out now. In Australia, you only go to work on Fridays." Now, that might sound funny, but that's what you do in your meditation. You want to pay packet every meditation. You know, you want to get bliss. "Yeah, I've got bliss meditation today." You got paid, it was Friday. Now you have to go back to work. In other words, you know, these meditations, they don't work. You've got to learn, you've got to experience, you've got to let go. So much stuff. But then eventually, you put in enough hours and eventually you do get the pay packet. And if on this retreat you haven't got a pay packet yet, don't worry, I guarantee the check's in the mail. That's what they say. It'll come sooner or later. So that stops all the expectations. You see the big picture. You're building up steam, you're building up your credit, you're building up this ability to let go, to be peaceful, and things are going to grow. They have to grow. I know they grow because I understand how this works. Which means you never really get frustrated. You want to be here, no expectations, and eventually it happens. And again, what happens? You get into this delightful breath, and when things do start to happen, please don't get excited. Because that's one of the other obstacles to meditation. Remember, it's all about being still, being nice and peaceful. And nice and still and peaceful, and something starts to happen. Yes, woohoo! You blow it. So please, no woohoos, no yes! Because if you do things like that, everything disappears. You've agitated your mind again. And this takes a lot of skill to be able to have these amazing experiences and just sit back and let them happen. And don't try and take notes to tell all your friends afterwards to impress them. "Hey, husband, this is what I did. I saw these beautiful lights, and these lights turned into gold, and it was so impressive and so wonderful," because that really embarrasses your husband when he's getting nowhere. It just, you know, gives him a hard time. So don't tell people about those experiences. We always like telling other people. That's against spiritual materialism. Keep it to yourself. Because otherwise you get jealousy up. Instead, just be still and enjoy. Don't try and take notes. You remember things afterwards. And number two, don't try and work it all out, what it means. Because that's the other obstacle for Western, highly educated people. And this beautiful light comes up into the mind, and you try and work it all. What does this mean? What color is it? What size is it? You're disturbing it all. I used to be a scientist. As a scientist, you were trained to do an experiment. You do an experiment and you let the experiment finish first before you work out what all the data means. You just collect the information. But if you start thinking about what the data means halfway through the experiment, then all the data which comes afterwards, you tend to sort of skew it. You tend to select the things which proves your theory and just deny the things which don't fit in with your theories. Which is why that in an experiment, you can't make any judgments at all. You can't try and work it out until the experiment is finished. And that's exactly what we do with meditation. At the end of meditation, maybe you can start thinking, what does this mean? What was this? How was this? Why did it happen? But during the meditation, you're just still collecting the experiences. So, limiter comes up, just leave it alone. Don't try and assess, what is this and why is this? Shut up. Because sometimes we try and collect information at the wrong time. So just let it be. Let it evolve. See what happens. And that is the other thing that we can't even control at all. I've seen this so often that people get very good at learning how to sort of, you know, let go of their body and be able to watch a breath, delightful breath, and the breath disappears and they get beautiful nimittas coming up. And it's amazing how they've done so well up to then. And then they start controlling. Then they start getting excited. Then they interfere. Now those beautiful lights have come up because you have been still, because you've been letting go, you've allowed these things to appear. And when they do appear, you have to go and mess it all up again. And that, to me, that's such a great shame. Just let it evolve by itself. It goes according to nature. You are a passenger, you're not the driver. Just let it happen. And because that occurs so often, people let go and a nimitta comes up and then they try and work with it and mess it up. I developed a little simile for myself, which I've shared with other people. It's like driving a car. And you get to a point when you're driving a car when you say, okay, I've driven enough, and you give the keys to somebody else. Here, you drive. And that's what I imagine myself doing. When a nimitta came up, I handed in the key, so I'm not driving at all anymore. And you know that on the last retreat, someone told me they've heard that simile so often, just to let go by handing the keys over to somebody else, that they had one of these dreams. Their dreams were they were driving in a car with Ajahn Brahm. They were driving, I was in the passenger seat, and they came to a cliff. And they were about to go over the cliff, and what did they do? They handed me the keys. And they let go. And they said at the bottom of the cliff, there was this really tight bend. And they thought, we're never going to make this. And I was sitting there and said, just let go. It'll be okay. And she went right down this cliff on top speed. And the car, you know, I had the keys, but I wasn't driving. No one was having the steering wheel. And it turned all by itself on this sharp curve. And went off into a beautiful place. So well done, that's a brilliant dream, that's exactly what you're supposed to do. But sometimes it's like that, it's scary. It's like, you know, you're going over a cliff, and then you give me the keys. And that's what it's like, your nimitta comes up, like you're going over a cliff. You know, if you can imagine me, just throw the keys to me. Take off the steering wheel, throw it out the window, whatever. Don't control. And that dream showed her she was perfectly safe. It all worked out wonderfully. She didn't crash and lose her life. So that takes a lot of trust and faith, but it actually works. You only start to control again because of fear. The fear that things will go wrong. The fears you will crash. The fears that you'll go crazy or something. You don't go crazy, you just get enlightened, that's all. So that's what you're supposed to be here for, I hope. So the next time that happens, when you do get these nimitta stages, please, just you've been doing wonderfully well so far, don't mess around. And if you do have difficulties letting go when there's a lot of power and lovely stuff coming up, imagine, take the keys out of the car, throw them out the window, or give them to me, so you can just totally let go
and see what happens. And of course, you have the time, not the time of your life, the time of your many lives. A great opportunity. Now, that just brings me up to talking a little bit about the nimittas, you know, about how they work. And this is actually just what happens to people, just when, as long as you go the right way, you follow the instructions, which is, you know, just sitting down, relaxing, not using effort, because if you use effort in the beginning, too much effort, you just get addicted to that controlling and the effort. A little bit of a nudge here, a nudge there is fine at the beginning. But then once you get into the breath, you know, if it doesn't actually come up because you choose to, it'll come up naturally anyway. Just watching the breath go in, the breath go out. The joy must come up somewhere. It's just a wonderful thing, so peaceful, so still. And some of you already experienced some of those energies, the great joy and happiness. It's just so beautiful, so nice. If it hasn't happened yet, don't expect it, don't want it, because that will stop it. Just be still, be peaceful, and it comes naturally by itself. It's just a natural event. And once it starts to get happy and still, you don't have to use any force to watch your breathing. You don't have to have willpower because it's just beautiful. You can't stop yourself. And so when it becomes beautiful like that, you're letting go a little bit more, which means you're more still, which means more energy, more power. The happiness comes up so much, it reaches a level because it's feeding your mind rather than your body. And it's like the five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, touching. They've got such a strength, and your mind is actually so weak that, you know, the five senses dominate the mind. But when you put energy into the mind and you restrain the five senses, these are the five senses, this is the amplitude, the strength of the mind. Soon the mind gets stronger, the five senses get weaker, until they get really pretty even, and then the mind pops up. Becomes stronger than seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And that's when this light pops up. It means, you know, the mind is strong. Stronger than the five senses. So that's why it dominates, that's why you can see it. And a lot of time it just flashes up. And then disappears again afterwards. It's about the same level, it pops up and it goes down again. But you're close. And what do? Just forget about the five senses. Be more still to give more energy up into the mind, so when it breaks through up through the surface, it stays longer and longer and longer. What gives it the power is stillness, not doing anything, and restraining the five senses. On this retreat, we do restrain the five senses, except the food sense, the taste sense. But at least we only do that twice a day. Delicious breakfast and a delicious lunch. A long time ago when we used to say, oh, monks only eat one meal a day. And some said, no, that's not right. You eat one feast a day, not one meal a day. Because, you know, we eat really well. So you eat two feasts a day, and breakfast and in lunch. You deserve it. But, you know, in the afternoon and evening, there's no sort of sensory stuff going into your mouth. You know, people don't dress up or wear makeup on this. So we're trying to restrain the senses, not excite them. And don't be afraid of nature, because nature is a very calming sense object. So you can go out, because the trees don't move that fast. You know, even the sunset is a very slow sunset, the dawn is very gentle. So when you get joy out of nature, it's not something which excites the senses, it actually calms them down. I just remember after 7 years as a monk in Thailand, I went to visit UK. And I went with Ajahn Sumedho, he took me up to, he was doing some tour, teaching tour of Scotland. We went to one person's house for a cup of tea in the afternoon. And I think his kids have the TV on, you know, in another room, but I could see through two doors the TV. And I was looking at that TV, now I'd been a monk for 7 years, hadn't seen the TV for 7 years, and I couldn't believe just how harsh that was. You know, the colours, it was so fast, every frame was moving so quickly. And it just gave you a headache. You know, this is just so hard and so sharp and so oppressive. Of course you get used to it when you see it every day. But if you haven't seen a TV for 7 years and you see it for the first time, then it's just, oh, that is, it's a torture to your brain. It moves too fast. Nature, however, moves very slowly. It's very calming. It doesn't excite. It actually calms you down. That's why that is not a problem for you to go and watch a sunset or go for a walk in a forest. That's not sensory indulgence. That calms you down. So all here, 5 days, 6 days, 7 days on this retreat, your senses get very calm. And if you don't believe me, there was one guy here during a range retreat, during a 3 month retreat. That was Fabian with the ponytail. And he said, "No, I'm not getting anywhere." And I said, "Yes, you are." He said, "No, I'm not." I said, "Okay, I'm going to ask you the next time the car from the monastery goes in, go to a shopping center. Go to the shopping center, go inside, and then come and tell me afterwards." And then he came after and said, "That was terrible, that was such hell." I said, "Yes, because you've calmed down so much. Now you realize how much you've calmed down on this retreat." He didn't realize it until because he goes to a shopping center every day when he was at home. But when he actually been meditating for a while and then went to the shopping center, he saw how hard that was and how harsh. Here you do calm down. So the five senses, they lose their power and they get weaker and weaker and weaker. And at the same time, the mind gets more and more energized. It gets all of your attention, gets all of your mental energy. Until it gets to that point, the mind gets strong, five senses get weak, and that is when you see these beautiful nimittas coming up. The shine of the strength of your mind. Now, the obstacles when nimittas come up, again, sometimes they're really, really powerful, because, your mind is pretty powerful. When the five senses disappear, that's a great sort of mind. You get a bit afraid of it, because anything which is powerful, which you don't understand, you are afraid of. Just like Asian people, I can't understand them, they are afraid of ghosts. Just because you don't understand them. Ghosts are cute. Ghosts are cuddly. Ghosts want to help you most of the time. At least they're just trying to get some help for themselves. They're not trying to harm or hurt you. But why people are afraid of those things is because they don't know them. They don't understand them. Same with these nimittas. You don't understand these things. That's why, this is way beyond me. That's why I have to talk about these things a lot until you get to understand what they are. So when they arrive, you know what to do. You don't get afraid of them. Let them come. They're beautiful. They're wonderful. And you don't need to do anything. They will stay. You know what happens to so many people when a nimitta first comes up? Yeah, it just flashes, first of all. The ping-pong nimittas, they just come and go. But then afterwards, some actually stays. But it's so common you've been meditating, the nimitta is over here somewhere. It's not central. It's just on the edge. It's like it's checking you out. Are you ready for me yet or not? And if you go looking for it, then it will run away. Your job, when the nimitta comes up into the corner of your mind, some of you have had this, if you haven't had this yet, you'll have it afterwards, is just be still, don't do anything. It's checking to see if you are ready. And then if you are ready, it will come into the center of your vision, all by itself. And if you get excited, it will go away again. Sometimes when I started working with these nimittas, they'd always be moving and running all over the place. And that was an obstacle. And it took me a long time to find a simile which worked for me and to share with other people. Because I always tried to control it. Come on, be still. And it would make it move even more. Obviously now you should understand how stupid I was. Every time I tried to do something, I was feeding it agitation. I needed somehow to let go and do nothing. And I remember one day, being a monk, I was shaving, being a man, shaving. And I noticed the image of myself in the mirror was moving. And I realized, the image is moving because me, I'm moving. And straight away you got this insight. Nimittas, that's what's happening. If when I'm looking in a mirror, you can try this, look in the mirror, and you try and hold the mirror still, the image is still moving inside the mirror because the one who's watching is moving. And I realize that's exactly what's happening in nimittas. In the nimitta stage, it's a reflection of the one which is watching, the consciousness, the mind. And if the mind is moving, your nimitta will be moving. If the mind is still, the one who is looking is not moving, then your nimitta will be still. So instead of putting my attention just out there with the object, I put attention on the one who was looking to make sure that was still. When I became still, the nimitta became still. And I trace that back, you know, right to even the beginnings of meditation. You know, you try and keep the breath still, it won't be still because you're not still. The one who is watching has to be still. Because so often in life we always put our attention out there somewhere. Even when we're meditating, you know, we're watching the breath, or you know, we're watching our body. But are you watching the one who's watching? And if you do that, you watch the one who's watching, if you understand what I mean, and keep that one peaceful, that one still, then meditation is very easy. That is the cause of all the restlessness. The one who is watching is not still. So the object will move. Just like looking in a mirror, the object will move because the one who's watching is moving. And that little understanding, that way of looking at my meditation just helped enormously overcome so many problems. So instead of worrying, what am I aware of, what's happening, am I sleepy, am I restless, even if the mind was having thoughts, okay, forget about the thoughts, they were just objects of the mind. I made sure I was aware of the one who was watching. I'm going to keep that one still. The objects weren't that important. The one who was watching was. Now when I say the one who is watching, I'm not talking about a soul or a self, because sometimes otherwise I get a whole heap of questions in the evening. Are you saying Ajahn Brahm is the self? What is it is doing the watching? Don't think this is just a way of looking. Just a perspective which happens to work. The skillful means. It's not an ultimate truth I'm talking about. So when you get to those nimitta stages, or even earlier, pay a little attention to the one who is watching. And also, that opened up another solution to so many obstacles in meditation. The one who is watching, how is that thing watching? How are you watching? Are you watching with wanting and desire? With ill will, not being happy? How are you observing your meditation? And it was from that I started developing this technique of always watching with peace, kindness and gentleness. It's the way I watched, the way I observed, was the key to success in meditation. Which is why you see on the back of people's t-shirts, make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's how you meditate. It doesn't matter what you're meditating on. Even if it's on thinking, just make peace, be kind, be gentle with those stupid thoughts. You know, if it's with sleepiness, just make peace, be kind, be gentle with your sleepiness. If it's nimittas, brilliant lights, just make peace, be kind, be gentle with the nimittas. The one who is watching is just being peaceful, being kind and being gentle. He doesn't move. So forget about the objects of your mind. Look about the one who's watching and how that person or that thing is watching. And then you have the great key to success in meditation. You find you're meditating with expectations, with wanting. That's a problem. So instead of watching out there, you're watching inside. And then meditation starts to work. And it's what happens all throughout the meditation. There's not different instructions for the beginners and different instructions for the adepts. It's not you do one thing when you're watching the breath and another thing when you're watching a nimitta. Exactly the same technique. It's you just being still, being peaceful, being kind, and being gentle, even with a nimitta. And sometimes people are not. They think they have to move that nimitta left and right, expand it, do whatever. That's not gentle at all. That's worked. They're not making peace. You're fighting. And you're not opening the door of your heart up to this experience. You think it's not good enough, I want it to be better. loving kindness respects a person for who they are, not for what they should be. Loving kindness respects your nimitta for what it is, not what it should be. And then you find the nimitta starts to glow, get brighter and brighter and brighter. It gets brighter because the stillness gives it more energy, because the kindness is such a pure, beautiful power source. And this is what happens, you're sitting there, and this nimitta is so still. And you don't do it, it just becomes gorgeous, amazing, powerful, radiant. You understand, those of you who know your suttas have gone to sutta class. It's one of the famous sayings of the Buddha. It's famous because it's been interpreted in the wrong way, you know, by a lot of forest monks. The saying is, this mind is radiant when the hindrances have been overcome. And some monks have said that means the original mind is radiant. There's no word original anywhere in that Pali. It says the mind freed from hindrances is radiant. The pabbasara jitta. That's what it means. And a lot of times when I read these sayings in Pali, you know, you had no reference point to it until you started looking at your meditation. Radiant mind, radiant mind. What does that mean? So, well, actually, my mind is radiant in these jhanas, or just beforehand, nimittas. So that is the radiant mind, and that's what it appears like. A light which is incredibly radiant, brilliant, like the sun. Where do you get to nimittas? The two little problems which people come up with, because you know, this is what I came up with. Sometimes it was so bright, I thought I'd go blind. It's like looking at the sun. If you go out in the Australian sun and look at it, you will go blind. It's bad for your eyes. But the thing was, this is not a visual object. This is a mental object. You're not seeing it with your eyes. It's not light falling on the retina. It's actually just the brightness of the mind. So you don't go blind. You can take as much as you like. And the other problem, which is a nice problem, which I'm sure many of you think, I wish I had this problem, was that sometimes the bliss got so strong that I thought that no human being can take so much ecstasy. That, you know, there must be a limit to how much pleasure you can actually take before exploding. And that, you know, that's how you perceive it. And then sometimes, you know, you think, oh, let's see what happens. And the one insight I found out, there's no limit to the ecstasy you can experience. You don't have to be afraid. Go for it. It will blow your mind how much joy and bliss the human mind can experience. Much more than your body. Isn't that encouraging? Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. And I'm saying this not to sell something, but to say, don't be afraid when that happens. Well, there's another little problem with nimittas when they come up, which is so common, is that when they first come up, people think, oh, this can't be a nimitta. You know, not me. You know, I just the starting meditation. Maybe the monks and the nuns, or maybe these people who've been meditating for years. This is my first retreat. A light comes out. It must be something else. It can't be something else. If it happens in this room, where are the windows? They're too high for you to be facing the sun. The sun comes up there and maybe at the door, but you have to be facing this way to be able to sort of, you know, see this light in the mind from the sun. None of you face that way, you face this way, and a lot of the time there's no light coming into this room. That's one of the reasons I made it this way, I designed it. I had to fight to make sure there were no windows, you know, at eye level. So it cannot be the sun. It cannot be the headlights of a car. It cannot be a flashlight. And if anyone still doubts, you know, I always bring on this retreat some eye shades, you know, courtesy of Singapore Airlines or Thai Airways, because when I go travel, they always give me these things. I actually take them and I keep them for you guys so that Singapore Airlines and Thai Airways can make some good karma. And I've done this often. People have come and say, oh no, I got this light in my mind, it can't be a nimitta. Use these.
and they've got these eye shades on. And they've got these eye shades on, they see this light, oh, someone's shining, and uh-oh, I've got eye shades on, it can't be. And it is a real nimitta. I've been teaching a long, long time now. And if you see a light in the mind, 98% of the time, it is a real nimitta. It's very, very rare for it to be something fake. And I say that from long experience. So if you do see a light in the mind, don't doubt it. You can take it for granted that that is an nimitta. Your mind is beginning to have enough energy and power to actually to manifest, so you can actually see it. It's a reflection of the one who's watching. And now you know what to do with it. Just be still, and it gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and lasts longer and longer and longer. And now it's so easy to meditate. It's nice to watch the breath when it's beautiful, but imagine watching this beautiful light in the mind, which is blissful and gorgeous. Of course, you can look at it for a long, 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 long time, because it's peaceful, it satisfies you, the mind just doesn't need to go searching for anything else, because it's totally satisfied, and it stays and stays and makes you even more still, until you can get into these amazing jhana states. But I'll talk more about the jhanas later on during this retreat. But in the meantime, I just want people to get close there and to develop these beautiful lights and nimittas. It doesn't matter what color they are. I know sometimes when you start talking about these things and some monks who don't know what they're talking about say, oh no, the blue light is the best. The purple lights. Or the yellow, the golden lights. Because I've been teaching a long time, you get sometimes different lights at different times, they're all good. It doesn't matter what colour they are, as long as they're beautiful. And the real nice ones, if it is, say, a blue, it's the sort of blue you will never ever see in the real world. It's more blue than any blue. More purple. A deeper purple than the rock band. If you know what I'm talking about. You know, I saw them once when they were just starting off, you know, years and years ago. And really rich colours that you never ever really see in the real world, but they're there because this is a mental image. And it doesn't matter what colour they are, as long as they're beautiful. I never forget this fellow. He was a pest exterminator. That was his job. He was a really good person. Other than that, he was a really kind, very gentle, very wonderful person. And he got into this deep meditation once, and you know, he said he saw this nimitta, but it was weird. It was a black nimitta, maybe because of his job. But he said it was, when I thought, this is really weird, I've never ever heard anyone else except this guy get a black coloured nimitta. So he never dismissed people. You always say, well, what was it like? And that's when he said, this was just blacker than any black I'd ever seen. And it was beautiful, it was like satin black, like deep black, powerful, it was just so beautiful. The blackest black, the deepest, purest, shimmering black I've ever seen in my life. It was gorgeous. Okay, that's a nimitta. The colour wasn't necessary, it was just the power it had on him, and the beauty, the shimmer, the depth of it. That was a sign that it was a really good nimitta. He's the only one I've ever known had that colour nimitta. So it doesn't really matter what the colour is. It doesn't matter what the size is. You know, the best ones, which just, you know, they usually develop anyway, it's like the moon or something. That's a classic one, the disc. But it doesn't have to be that colour. I should mention also that sometimes when people see nimittas, they see the sheet of light first of all, just like the whole thing is light. Which is, no, that's a nimitta, right? That's your mind, but it's not focused enough yet. It'll focus by itself after a while. So if you see a sheet of light, yeah, that's nimitta, don't worry about that, that's good. As long as it starts to be beautiful. At first it won't be that light and be pretty dark because it's spread out over the place. Little tricks, and I say these tricks because it's not what you do, it's what I program into your mind. If you see a sheet of light somewhere, the trick is, you look for the part of that sheet of light, the whole screen, which is the brightest and most beautiful. And some people say, well, do you mean I'm supposed to do something? No, I've already done it for you.
Because it's amazing what happens in those stages of meditation. That stage comes up, maybe sort of another year or 2 years' time, it doesn't matter, it could be this afternoon. You see a beautiful sheet of light, and a thought comes up, look for the most beautiful part in it. And afterwards, you realize that came from me. I programmed you. Just like Ajahn Chah used to program me. That's how it actually works. It's not you do anything, I've already told you to do something. And those programs, I'm not quite sure how this works, but when you get into the deep meditations, those little programs, they have the most power. They always tend to come up in the deep stages. You know, getting somewhere in meditation, you get a beautiful nimitta, you know, there's a problem there, and suddenly you just hear Ajahn Chah's voice. And I remember this, that was years and years ago he said that. And that's just all you need, just to go further. Just a little bit of letting go. It's amazing, this magic of the mind, and why teachers who know what they're talking about can really help at that particular time. They're not helping now, it's not some psychic thing. It's a totally natural phenomena. Things we've said resonate when you're at that time of the meditation. And you just look for the most beautiful part in that nimitta. You see the most gorgeous part. Naturally, you go towards that because it's the most gorgeous part that fills up the mind, and soon you get a very, very bright light in the mind. It's very gorgeous, and you enjoy it there. And when you do that, you understand why also. We don't have bells to start the meditation and bells to stop the meditation, because they just really just cause so much interruption. Sometimes a nimitta comes up, gong, and you have to come out. And as that stops so many people becoming enlightened, imagine if the Buddha was standing sitting under the Bodhi tree. Gong! He would have never got enlightened. So this way of meditation is not just free and easy. This is powerful meditation retreat. So if those lights come up, just you keep on going. Don't worry about your breakfast or your lunch or anything. Don't worry about coming to any talk. The reasons why you eat, the reasons why you give those talks is so you can get those stages, so you can experience the bliss and beauty of meditation. So don't throw it away for stupid food. If you really are hungry, and you know you just had a big nimitta experience or jhana, you just come and tell me, and I'll just go and ring out Pizza Hut or whatever and get a special delivery for you. You know, in the evening at 10 o'clock, I don't care when, because, you know, that I want you to have no fear at all that, you know, you can actually just enjoy these states of meditation, because they're very worth it. And later on I'll say just how this works in with the insight. You say, well, these are beautiful states of meditation, but what do they mean when it gets to enlightenment? Yes, so what? You just blissed out, had this incredible experience. So what? Tomorrow I'll say just how that changes a lot of the way you look at life, at yourself, at the mind, and just how you use that for incredibly powerful insights. So many people in the world, they ask about the nature of the mind. Already somebody was talking about what is the mind anyway. And of course there's lots of evidence you can read in books and see in videos of near-death experiences of people having a mind or the body is dead and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's interesting, it's fascinating, it feeds your intellect, but it doesn't really change the way you look at life. But you have some of these meditation experiences where your body totally vanishes. You get incredible energies going through your body or going through into your mind and get these powerful lights. You are face to face with this thing you call the mind. It's right there for you. This is not what you read in a book, it's what you're experiencing right now, directly, with very strong mindfulness. You're not dull, you're not imagining. This is real, more real than what you're experiencing now. Now that changes you. Just one thing which is obvious is if you get even these nimitta experiences, powerful nimitta for a while, you know this body is not yours. It dies, yes, so what? You've experienced direct face-to-face, as it was, with your mind. This thing, the citta, whatever you wish to call it. At least you know that that is totally independent of your body. Bodies are sick, old. That doesn't affect that nimitta at all. You may have dementia. You may have be a woman, a man. You may be highly educated or just gone through grade 1, 2 or 3. That doesn't affect that nimitta at all. Girls' nimittas, boys' nimittas, gay nimittas, they're totally the same. When they say men are for Mars and women are for Venus, all they mean is your bodies and your culture. When it gets to your mind is from the sun. That's what it looks like anyway. It's a beautiful sun in the mind. That is where we all come together, no matter what race, religion, gender or sexual orientation. That is what we share together. It's an incredible mind. And if you want to know what it is, you've come to the right place. You're going to experience it. And as the Buddha said, it's one of his similes of the goldsmith. If a person is a goldsmith, they've got to take some gold, which is always impure, because it's always got these other elements mixed in with it. They've got to take that gold and purify it. So there's 100% gold, no tin, no selenium, no iron, just gold, 100%. And then they said they can test its qualities and find out what gold truly is. Just when you've got just your mind, your sixth sense, no seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting or touching, just your mind, then you can understand what it is. You can test it. And the other part of that simile says, once you've got pure gold, it's an extra part of that metaphor. Gold, when it's pure, you can bend it, you can fashion it. When it's 100% pure, it's very malleable, people tell me about gold. If it's got any other elements, it's hard to bend, it's hard to sort of shape into things. But pure gold is really soft, in a sense you can fashion it. And he said that was like the mind as well. When your mind is that pure, it's amazing how you can start fashioning it and doing all sorts of amazing things, like psychic powers. But that's like the free gift in the cornflake box. You know, it's not what we have cornflakes for. You know, it's like the free gift that they use to sell things, but that's not part of real Buddhism. So just find out what your mind is, first of all. And then, not only you have a great time, you start to learn something. The last little simile, just to make this very clear. Once there was an emperor, and this emperor was extremely powerful, but no one knew what this emperor was. Because every time the emperor appeared in public, the emperor had these big boots on, which went up to the thighs, had trousers, the bottoms of which went to the calves, so they overlapped the boots, had a jacket, the bottom of which overlapped the top of the trousers, had long sleeves to the wrists and a high collar around the neck. And the emperor had these gloves which overlapped the end of the sleeves, and had lastly had a helmet which covered his whole the whole head and overlapped the top of the jacket. So there was no part of the emperor was visible. All you saw were the five pieces of clothing: the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves and the helmet. So when the emperor appeared in public, no one knew who the emperor was, whether it was a girl or a boy, whether it was old or young, whether it was Chinese or Indian or Caucasian or even Eskimo. No one could see the emperor, even though it was so powerful. And I think you understand the simile. The emperor is your chitta, your mind. Incredibly powerful, but you've never seen it. You don't know its gender, or its age, or its race. And the only way you can find out is to take all those five pieces of clothing off. Take off the helmet, the gloves, the jacket, the trousers and the boots, to see the emperor without any coverings. You take off seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching, and all the thoughts connected with those five senses, until there's nothing left. No more coverings, just your mind. then you understand exactly who, or rather what, this emperor is, which controls your life, experiences, causes you grief, fear, anxiety, anger, love, beauty, kindness. You find out what this thing is at last. And this is how you take off those clothings, how you undress the emperor, which is your mind. Da da da. So, not many jokes in that talk, but you know, hopefully it's interesting. The problems of meditation, and then into the nimittas, how to deal with them, and why. Very good. Okay. So.